start off by saying good morning, I guess, and thank everyone for getting out of bed early and being here. I was going to say a cold morning, it wasn't so cold. But thank you very much for coming and welcome. In this month of June, as you know, we've been doing a series of seminars, breakfast briefings in the area of injuries law and compensation for injuries. And this morning, we're slightly away from the mainstream, I guess, of common law, the typical common law, and we're looking at ways that people obtain compensation for their injuries apart from common law. And so we're looking at VOCAT, the Victims of Crime Assistance Tribunal, and we're looking at the Sentencing Act. Our two presenters are Joanne Piggott and Miguel Belmar. Joe will speak first and Miguel second, and we'll save the questions till the end. just to take you through the timetable, Joe will present now for about half an hour until about 8 o'clock or so. We'll then have a break for 10 or 15 minutes for a chance of another cup of coffee. And then Miguel will present from about 8:15 till 8:45, 5 or 10 minutes for questions, and then get you away from here before 9 o'clock for a good day's work. I'll start by introducing Joe to you. Joe's an experienced practitioner, been admitted for over 20 years and been at the bar for 15 years. Joe's practice is mainly in the areas of crime and family law, and it's through the criminal side of that, I guess, that Joe has experience in the area of VOCAT, and therefore she brings to us a great deal of experience and a great deal of expertise in the area. Please welcome Joanne Piggott.
One of the difficulties in talking to a group such as the people here this morning is that there, and I've looked to see who's attending, there are people obviously who have an enormous amount of experience and even written articles on this area of VOCAT, and then I presume there are some people who don't have a great deal of experience. So I've tried to give a few handy hints in the paper about perhaps actually making the application, how it actually goes through by stages, and to those who are well and truly old hands at it, that's probably totally unnecessary. It's a very interesting area in the sense that, unlike perhaps some of the other jurisdictions and where there's a lot of precedents and very predictable in many ways outcomes, I've found that this area is one in which, first of all, the beneficial sort of nature of the act is such that it is often, I think, quite dependent upon the tribunal member before you're appearing as to how generously, and I may be being quite cynical, they will interpret some of the claims. At the present stage, each magistrate is having a week in VOCAT, whether they like it or not. They have 1 week and then the next one moves along. Some of them enjoy it and bring to it quite a special sort of flavour, because I think in many cases victims of crime feel that they're forgotten, feel very angry, feel that they've been very hard done by. One of the other difficulties is that frequently victims' expectations are very high. They've all heard of someone who's been awarded a holiday, a laptop computer, self-defence classes, glasses, and the list goes on and on. You may or may not be aware that the actual application form, and it can be downloaded from the internet, is a form, and I've got a shrunken size of a tick the box, and frequently by the time that victims reach the door of the tribunal or even the solicitor's door, they've all ticked primary victim and they've all filled in a lot of expenses that are just not claimable. And that is one of the difficulties, I think, in this area, that to then bring people back down to probably what they are going to be able to claim and have some reimbursement for. When I was working with the Attorney General, Jan Wade, shortly prior to the Act being 1996 Act's been introduced, the cost of running VOCAT, or the Victims of Crime Jurisdiction, exceeded what it cost to run all the magistrates' courts in Victoria. And as a result of that, there was extreme pressure to cut it back so that sort of payment suffering, cash payments were not made. It was just really sending the state coffers on that area quite broke. So the Act was introduced, and removed from that was the element of a cash payment. And then there was the Amendment Act, which reintroduced the section for special financial assistance. And I've noted that I did have as an attachment, and appears to have been not included, there is a special financial assistance maximum minimum awards, and each category, A, B, C and D, has a maximum. And I'll run through that when I start the actual going through the talk. But I think that's one of the things to keep in mind when people do come to see you. Often their expectations are extremely high. Some people just want their counselling and medicals. Others have this expectation they're going to get a holiday to Queensland and a lump sum, etc., etc. The interesting things about the Act are that, first of all, we're probably all aware, the tribunal is defined on the balance of probabilities that an act of violence has occurred. And that doesn't can be the case whether or not anyone's been charged, or even whether the matter has been reported to the police. Now, obviously, the more information the tribunal has to establish that the act of violence occurred, the better. People, for many reasons, don't report. That could be infrequently cases of domestic violence or fear for reprisals from the perpetrator of the crime, the length of time, their social or cultural background, and those matters should be put before the tribunal so that they're not going to be knocked out before they've even started. The hearings are generally open to the public. They can be closed, and again, it depends again upon the submissions made and reasons. Many of the magistrates hearing the matters as tribunal members prefer to have the court open, but in practical terms, at this designated time, often people are asked to leave the court. Not that the court's closed. I've been in there waiting for other criminal matters, and the clerk's come along and said, look, this is VOCAT, please go out, it's not closed. So in practical terms, you're probably going to be the only person in there. The tribunal takes, unlike a normal magistrate's court, a more inquisitorial role. It's not uncommon for the tribunal to direct that an applicant be independently psychologically assessed, and that report and the guidelines in the practice directions will set out what report back to the tribunal will take. And it is often a very, very detailed report. There are is a specified panel of psychologists used by the tribunal. That list is not open to the public. I tried to obtain it the other day, and I was told, no, it's closed. But they do have a specialised panel. The police files are usually obtained in the case where the matters have been reported. And really, the tribunal can, like in a European system, make its own inquiries. It's also not uncommon for the tribunal member to directly address the applicant, either on oath or in a more informal way. The legislation indicates that the actual hearings are to be run in an informal way, but my experience has been that in fact is not quite the case. There's still a very high degree of formality in the sense that the tribunal members sitting up at their bench, and the only real difference in many ways is that they might chat a little bit more and have the applicants seated at the table with them. But there still is quite a high degree of formality in it. I've gone through in the first and the background that the mandatory refusal for the grounds of mandatory refusal for awards, and unless there's special circumstances, one might be that the act of violence is not reported, that the person attending didn't assist, and that will all come out of any police reporting, that there was obviously collusion with a perpetrator, or that there was an earlier application for the same offence or same matter. I've gone on then to say the matters to which the tribunal must have regard. That's at section 54. The applicant's behaviour at the time is highly relevant. There are situations, and I've been involved in situations, for example, where there's been a fight and the applicant has been the one who's either instigated the first act of violence, the first punch, and then probably suffered quite serious consequences. One fellow acted for was struck in the nose and he lost his sense of smell, which affected his whole lifestyle, lost weight, etc., all those things. But his award was reduced quite significantly from the highest amount in his category to about half because of his behaviour. So that's something always to take into consideration, and perhaps even warn the applicant prior to coming to court. Any criminal record will be obtained by the tribunal, and they will have that. They will also have the police summary, but in many occasions won't show that to the applicant or the legal representative of the applicant if it contains other police material which is of a sensitive nature. So to a certain degree, the information that the tribunal may have may not be the same as what your instructions are, and that can lead to some difficulties when there's a reduction of award. One of the things also is to keep your eye on is whether the act occurred in Victoria. Now that might sound quite obvious, but it's particularly relevant when there's been a series of related acts, such as a sexual abuse which occurs over a numerous occasions over a long period of time and in one state to the other. That again can affect cut-off dates as far as obtaining assistance. There's a case I've referred to of Simmons and against VOCAT, and this was a situation where an applicant was at a nightclub and sustained a knee injury. No one was charged. It was a couple of chaps that the young woman claimed were fighting. She sought to have the act of violence defined by the assault on her and was unsuccessful. The basis being that it was not an act of violence in the sense that it wasn't a criminal act, because it could have been a negligent act and there was a huge lack of corroborated evidence as to what the actual fact situation had turned out to be. Another case is Denison against Vocan. It was a case involving a train driver. He was driving the train. Someone was chosen to a suicide by putting their head on the train. Train tracks, and he ran over them. He claimed that there was an act of violence. There was no doubt that there was an act, but the reason his claim failed was that there would have been no intent of the deceased to cause injury to him. So it was the deceased's lack of intent from which that failed. One of the, I think, most interesting cases that I've read on the issue of direct result of an offence, and it was, I thought, quite a long bow to draw. The applicant in this case, and it should be on bottom of page 6, was the discussion in that case of the meaning of direct. The applicant was a heroin addict. He was in his 20s. He made a claim for methadone treatment to date, $850 for drug toxification, dental treatment to date, cost of methadone treatment for not more than 2 years, assistance for treating hepatitis C. He also sought some assistance for tertiary education and a laptop. The offences were committed on him when he was 10 and a half and they were of a sexual nature. The offender was convicted and imprisoned, and the evidence on part of the applicant was that he had suffered progressive long-term psychological damage as a result of the abuse. It was alleged by him that his heroin addiction was a direct result of the offences, and there was extensive discussion by Justice Strong in relation to the consideration of the word direct. The interesting thing that I found about this case was that Strong was satisfied that the but-for test was made out, but he went on to say that it was probably a cause or the cause of his heroin addiction. And I was interested because I thought a probably, in my view, wouldn't have got him over the line, but it got him home and hosed on that one. The dental treatment was awarded on the basis that Strong found that people such as heroin addicts frequently neglect their health. And he didn't obtain the whole amount, but about two-thirds, three-quarters of the amount of a dental treatment. The application for his tertiary was knocked back on the basis that he could get hex, and it was probably just going that bit too far. The interesting thing, and I think a lot of the cases, is the quality of the candidate, the genuineness, the actual ability to make some attempt to get on with their lives, frequently seems to influence how much they actually, or what expenses are paid. And in this case, the applicant was seen as quite an outstanding young man. There'd been, the other people in his family had not fallen to the wayside. He'd come from a good family, was making significant attempts to rectify his problems, and he was highly commended for that. But it's a case perhaps to keep in mind, because a lot of the applicants that I've had have had other problems which have resulted in things such as drug abuse, but the psychological report, and there was psychological evidence in this case, both by the applicant and by the tribunal itself, which made an independent assessment of him, to say that it was highly likely that his substance abuse had caused from the sexual problems suffered as a child. One of the probably main things to consider, and it might sound straightforward, is whether the person falls into the category of primary or secondary victim. And I see that there is someone sitting in the audience here from a firm which had a recent case where, on all intents and purposes, it would have seemed that the person was merely a witness to an event and would have fallen quite clearly into category two, and thus really only been able to claim the medical counselling expenses. But because of their actions, and I refer to the couple of cases, Smith against VOCAT and Hall against VOCAT on pages 8 and 9, because of the person's actions shortly after the event in going to the aid of or trying to assist the primary victim, they were actually moved then into a category of being a primary victim. And you'll see from the legislation that a primary victim can also be someone who is injured as a result of going to the aid of or assistance of a primary victim if they believed, even if they only believed, that the person was a victim, and in fact the fact situation maybe turn out that they weren't a victim, the primary victim was not a victim of crime. So there's a very subjective element of the person's belief in inspiring their actions to go to the assistance. So even though when you look at a case that someone might quite clearly be a secondary victim, don't give up, because I think that if you really look at the analysis of what actually happened at the time, and in Smith and Hall, in Smith's case and Hall, Smith was a young child. She came downstairs, heard there was a fight, her parents were estranged, turns the light on, her father stops, I think, hitting her mother. She then goes to the aid of her mother and tries to attend to her. The tribunal found then that she was merely giving first aid and that she wasn't really assisting. It was that it was after the event. In Hall's case, the lady hears a fight outside. She goes outside, sees someone slumped on the pavement, goes and literally tries to pick them up. She gets blood all over her. She holds and comforts the person who's still conscious until the ambulance arrives. In that case, she was seen as a primary victim. So it's a very, very subjective analysis or test as to whether someone falls in the secondary or primary victim. And I think that one of the things that is interesting is that secondary victims, that's fine, it might be easy, but don't perhaps close the gates on whether the person may also fall into the category of a primary victim. And as I said at the commencement, it is a very beneficial legislation, and it's to be construed in that way. My experience has been that all of the tribunal members are endeavouring to assist, and if at all possible, will interpret the fact situations in a fairly generous way. Going on then to give you a bit of a rundown on the loss of earnings, and I've listed some of the material on pages 8 and 9 which are required when you're making a claim. The practice directions that you can obtain on the website, there's quite a number of them, and if you open those you'll find that they list in quite a bit of detail what one's needed for an application, what sort of information. So that ensures that you're fairly well prepared by the time the application gets to the tribunal. I've listed on 11 on onwards some of the expenses that might be incurred for the secondary victims. They are limited to $50,000 for medical expenses, and then in up to exceptional circumstances, an award up to $20,000 for loss of earnings can be made. Again, the practice directions obtained on the website list the loss of earning categories and the information required. Primary victims don't need to show exceptional circumstances. The case law indicates that exceptional circumstances is to be interpreted in the same manner as exceptional circumstances is interpreted in the Sentencing Act, cases such as Kent and Wilson, where it has to be something out of the ordinary, something quite extraordinary. Again, the very nature of the tribunal is that they do try to assist within reasonable limits, so it is not quite as daunting as it may seem, the exceptional circumstances. One of the things to notice about the third category of related victims is that there's only a total pool of 100,000. So if you have 10 members of a family who classified as related victims, obviously there's going to be, the cake is going to be cut up in some cases into quite small pieces. All related victims applications are to be made only to the Melbourne Registry. There's a section in the Act which requires, and on the form it requires notification of the applicant to notify the tribunal of who they may make an application. And that's particularly important when there might be a de facto, a parent, a child, etc. So it's something to keep in mind, that it's information that they must advise. And it's the only section in the Act requires a penalty if they don't, and there's a penalty units of 50 penalty units if they do not make the information available. The last category is an applicant for funeral expenses, and that applicant must not be a related victim. So you can't sort of claim under related victim for burying your child or parent and then make a separate application as well for the funeral expenses. After that, I go on to talk about the, or go on to set out the details of the special financial assistance, which was inserted by the 2000 Act. And it only requires, it is only available to primary victims. It's limited in the categories, and currently the maximum award for Category A is $10,000, and that involves any sexual penetration or attempted murder. Category B, the maximum is $3,250. Category C, $1,300, and Category D, $650. However, those categories can be uplifted. So you might, that the offence may fall within a particular category, but it can, under certain circumstances, and I've set out below on page 13 the circumstances in which there can be an uplifting from category, say, B to C or higher. And this is in particular where the dates are important and the location that the Act must have called in Victoria. And you'll notice that it's only applying to events of acts of violence after the 1st of July, and then it goes on with sexual offences. There are other dates to be aware of. Page 14, I've set out for you where the uplifting can occur. Now, I'll take you again further on through the paper to TAC against VOCAT, and that is just one of the many cases, it's on page 15, which sets out a discussion, and I know it's not particularly outstanding case, other than the fact that it deals with a substantial loss of use of a motor mechanic, and gives a good discussion about how that the very serious injury was a very serious injury for him because of the nature of his work, whereas for another type of applicant it may not be regarded as a very serious injury. Now, one of the things that is quite common is for people to be late in making their application. There's a 2-year cut-off, and it is certainly not fatal to someone's claim that they don't claim within that time. I've referred to the case against L against VOCAT, and that sets out a very, very good analysis of the reasons why the particular applicant failed to make her claim in time. It was slightly unusual in the sense the applicant was aged 37. The alleged criminal acts were sexual and physical assaults which occurred when she was between 15 and 16 years of age. She was claiming for various items, including counselling costs for services that she'd already incurred. The first event occurred when she was 5. The offender couldn't be clearly identified, the passage of time, her age, etc., etc. She was extremely unfortunate in the sense she alleged that when she was 13 she was raped, and again the charges were unsubstantiated, and although there was a police report, didn't proceed. Her reasons for applying for extension of time included her age, her ability to identify the offences as criminal acts, and the thrust of her application was that at the time when the acts occurred, she was young, she didn't realise, in particular at the first one she was 5, that it was a criminal act. When she was older, she claimed that she believed that the behaviour which was perpetrated upon her was normal. And it wasn't until she claims that she had sexual assault counselling with CASA some years later that she came to the recognition that those acts were criminal acts. The interesting thing, and it was picked up by the tribunal, that she had extensive counselling from CASA from 1996, and yet did not make her claim until 2004. So there were 8 years in which one would have thought that CASA councillors, and she would have been advising of some of her rights, but also she would have probably been fully aware for that 8 years that what was happening was criminal. But, and again, the tribunal permitted her application. She received 55 counselling. She had received 55 counselling sessions. The tribunal found that there were numerous other factors in her life which caused her the problems for which she needed counselling, and therefore was only prepared to award 10 for those. Now, Miguel is going to talk about other avenues for compensation, but one of the other issues is whether an award of compensation under another part of legislation is to be taken into account. And I've referred to the case of Eads against VOCAT. Robert Eads in 2004 was killed while driving to work. In 2006, the driver of the other vehicle was convicted of culpable driving causing death. His widow claimed compensation under the Accident Compensation Act. Pursuant to Section 92 capital A of that Act, she received $207,390, a pension, reasonable funeral expenses, like expenses and costs. In 2005, she made an application to VOCAT in her capacity as a related victim and sought assistance for distress as a result of Eads' death. The related victims is also the only other category where distress is actually identified as a category or grounds for the application. It wasn't disputed she was a related victim or that she had suffered to distress. The issue was the effect of the compensation and whether there was an element in the 207,000 odd compensation that she had been awarded for pain and suffering or distress. Now, the council acting in that is a very competent member of council, not on this list though, unfortunately, who did, I thought, very, very competent submissions on the issue that there was no distress element in there. The thrust of the applicant's case was that she had not received payment for distress and was therefore entitled to an award under the Act. That was refused, being that there was an inference of an element of distress and that the lump sum payable was in part compensation for the distress suffered. So really, I think that the gates are closed really on all other avenues and you can't sort of double dip or get one thing here and then one thing there. She was awarded $50,000 by the tribunal, but from that was deducted the $207,000. So it would have led with a bizarre result that she'd get a negative award. So effectively she got nothing. Now, the last part of the paper, I've just run through the step-by-step process for those who don't deal in this area of how to make an application. But there is one case that I haven't mentioned, and I'll very quickly run that. And it's probably very well known. In fact, there are two cases involving this particular family. That's Gandhi against VOCAT. If you read one case, I'd say read this because it's a bit like a hamburger. She'd claimed for almost everything in this. It's not in the papers, but I'll give you the citation. It's Gandhi against VOCAT on the general list, 2006, VCAT 2676, 13th of January 2006. And Gandhi against VOCAT General, 2006, VCAT 338, 27th of February 2007. In the situation was such that the Gandhi family were tenants on a farm. They were partridge and pheasant farmers. There was a fairly generous rental arrangement with Mr. Baker, who was interested in getting involved with the business. He at one stage said to them, if you don't leave when I ask you, I'll make sure you leave by force. Obviously not perhaps the type of landlord one would necessarily want to be involved with. He asked them to leave in December, January. They didn't. And so in the middle of the night, two very strong-looking, threatening individuals turned up with a large torch and a large stick or piece of wood. It was literally the middle of night, say 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning or even later. The parents were awoken. They were told that they'd really better leave or something fairly unpleasant might happen to them. So in the middle of the night, they got their children out, got a car and left the property. So the matter was reported to the police. The police claimed it was a civil matter, which seems slightly unusual, and said that no criminal offence had occurred. They then made there was quite a horrendous sort of series of events that took place after that, about that they couldn't get their car out, their belongings were returned considerable time, I think over a year later, damaged and a lot of them missing. The hearing aid that Mrs. Gandhi had relied on was not there. She claimed loss of earnings. The husband relocated interstate for fear of harm, and the rest of the family were in Victoria, and they claimed things like $18,000 for special financial assistance for personal items, $150,000 for loss of earnings. She obviously didn't realise there was a cap on it. Travel expenses of $5,500 to go for a trip for England. And so on and so forth. She said she suffered a mental disorder by way of post-traumatic stress disorder. And replacement of hearing aids for $7,600. She was awarded the $7,600 for medical expenses, saying that was reasonably incurred. And that was it. The second case, she sought loss and damage to property of $8,000, compensation for car rental, $476, an alarm, $15,000, self-defence classes, $680, holiday, $5,975, and then a lesser loss of income. And she sought to convert the counselling that she'd been awarded into cash and wanted private tutoring for her son. The claim for property was refused. The car rental was refused, interestingly, on the basis that whilst it was a reasonable expense, the rental had actually been taken out by her sister, and therefore the claim failed on that basis. So some of the attention to detail when people are making claims is quite important. Alarm installation and self-defences were refused on the basis that there was no clear evidence these were essential to the psychological health and well-being of the applicant. Holiday in Queensland, 7 years had passed between the event and when the holiday. So that's another thing to keep in mind. Holidays are occasionally awarded, but it's clear psychological evidence is by way of a psychologist's report, and also that the nexus in time is very important to keep an eye on. One of the reasons I think some of these things may have been knocked back is because after a while the tribunal members seem to become a little bit perhaps cynical if someone loads up their claim a little too much. And that's just by way of a practical hint. Loss of income, she claimed over the $20,000 limit. The loss can only be awarded for a 2-year time after the event. The tribunal did find that if the events had not occurred, she probably would have returned to work earlier. At the time, she was not working, but said, I would have gone back to work, but these ruined my life. So they varied the award and allowed her a loss of income of $10,000. The court did not, or the tribunal did not, convert the counselling to cash. There is absolutely no power to do that. Private tutoring for his son was refused on the ground only that it was compensation for her son and not for herself. And if it was stated that if he had made the claim, it may well have been awarded. The Gandhi case is an interesting one because it does discuss the issues of variation of an award. Applications can be made up to 6 years after the award being made for a variation of that award. And the case also discussed issues such as, well, how does the tribunal look at it? Is it just purely to look at the whole case again? Can you have a second shot at your application through a variation and better prepare? And the answer probably is yes. Rather than appealing, it might be a more practical way. And it was the case was quite candid in discussing, should we just look at it again because you've gone and got a bit more information to boost up an aspect of your application? And the answer was yes. And the answer sort of seems to indicate that if knocked back on something, perhaps the way to go might be an application with variation, perhaps with additional psychologist reporting, additional material to support the initial application. I can see the time's going on, and I think that is probably about all I have time for. As I said, it's a strange jurisdiction in the sense that claims that you think might not get up, depending on perhaps the nature of your candidate, how genuine, what they have actually done, who you appear before. There are some tribunal members who've got much tighter clasp on the purse strings than others. And the thing that I think is time and time again that to keep in mind is that frequently victims have a very unrealistic expectation of what the tribunal can do as a making award, and that perhaps is our job to talk them back down to earth on it. But apart from that, it's one of the very rewarding areas to work in, and you really don't have an opponent. One thing to keep in mind, and I did try to find it before I came in before, the tribunal, and I don't have the actual section in front of me, can notify interested parties. And I've had cases where the alleged perpetrator of sexual abuse has been notified and they have a right to, if they wish, attend. That can be obviously considerably distressing for the victim and can complicate matters if there's been no charges. So that is something also to warn the applicant about when making or preparing their matter. I think I'll hand over to Michael for Miguel's speech or a bit of a break.